What is now known as the American Southwest is richly populated with diverse cultures that are indigenous to this broad landscape that spans two major watersheds, those of the Colorado River and the Rio Grande. Science has it that the forebears of these cultures wended their way into the region by way of the now submerged Bering landmass over a period of thousands of years. Culture bearers refer to tribal origins recounted in creation myths that have indeed rooted these indigenous peoples to their respective home habitats. They live where they came to cultural consciousness, and their mythic ties to homeland have provided them with intuitive understanding of how to comport themselves in balance with the flow of nature. To the traditional members of these cultures, a deep sense of the sacred pervades every cranny of the natural world. This is Jack Leffler. Welcome to The Lore of the Land, a radio series that celebrates the relationship of biodiversity to cultural diversity and its fragile but vitally important offspring, cognitive diversity. On our program, we'll listen to points of view expressed by members of the Hopi and Tewa peoples. The Hopi Indians live on arid mesas in the Colorado River watershed, and the Tewa Puebloan Indians live in the northern Rio Grande watershed. Vernon Masayaspa spent many years of his life as an educator for the Hopi people. Thereafter, he was elected chairman of the Hopi Tribal Council. More recently, he has vigorously defended his Hopi homeland against interlopers from without. He grew up listening to the points of view of his elders. Here, he briefly recounts part of the story of how the Hopi people first arrived in their homeland.
There's a point east of the Big Colorado, on the banks of Little Colorado River, a very sacred site we call Sibabwini, which is our emergence. It's our umbilical cord that connects us to our motherland. And we came up to the top. The elders apparently figured this is where we're going to stay. Those days, people were different, and they had a very close connection with the Creator. They discovered that a person was already living there because they found foot tracks. They finally found a man, Maasal, working his field, and they approached Maasal. "Is this your land?" "No, it's not my land, but I take care of it." Then the question, "Can we stay here with you?" And Maasal said, "That's not up to me. That's up to you people." And he told them to look around. "What do you see?" "It's barren land. So it's a hard place to settle. It's poor and yet it's rich. So if you decide to stay, that would be your decision." So they finally agreed that they would stay. Maasal says, "Well, then you have to help me steward this land." And they agreed to a covenant. So we decided that we would live with Maasal, help steward the land, live according to his law.
For part of his career, Philip Tewalatstua served as the assistant director of the United States Geographical Survey. He reflects on the importance of the place of emergence to the Hopi people.
"Most Hopis have never been to our place of emergence, the Sibabwini. But there isn't a Hopi that doesn't know about it. That if you mention the emergence, I think your mind travels instantly over to that place in the Little Colorado River, near the confluence of the Colorado River and the Little Colorado River. Your mind goes there, and you have an image of that place. And you also have a sense of direction to it, and probably if you have listened to the stories, you know the direction of it, you know in your mind what it looks like, you even have a sense of how long it would take you to get there. You know, it's an arduous journey. And then I think your mind would take a leap if you were properly initiated and were a person who would be qualified to go there because you had been properly indoctrinated into certain ceremonies, ritual societies of the tribe, then you would also think, let's see, I'm going to need prayer feathers, and I need to do certain things before I would make that journey. And all of this then coming right out of your conscious, the tribal conscious, and you think about this place and you know that not only are you connected to it, all Hopis, whoever lived or died are connected to it, and you have a sense of it that is totally profound. Now that's much different, it seems to me, than saying, well, I got to go down to Phoenix today.
250-odd miles to the east of Hopi country, east of the Continental Divide, is the Tewa world. Rena Swensel was born into the Naranjo family of the Santa Clara Pueblo, situated on the banks of the Rio Grande. Although Dr. Swensel is highly educated within the context of Western culture, her roots to homeland run deep.
The way the old Pueblo people were trying to make sense of what was around them. You know, here, especially in the Southwest, you look around you and you see that horizon, 360-degree horizon around you. And then you see that blue with the clouds going over you. And the sense they made of it was the center. You are the center. At any point that you stand in the Southwest, you are the center and you are in containment. At any point that you stand in, you as the center. And the Pueblo people really picked up on that and said, look, we live within the earth bowl. This is where we dwell. Wherever we are at the center, which is literally true. I mean, that's what we experience every day. We experience this in a very central way every day. And being at the center, seeing that far horizon with the mountains that contain us in this earth bowl, and all the, you know, the symbolic kiva bowls that the Pueblo people make with the mountains along the rim of it, is all about that. And then the earth is covered by the sky basket. And you're talking about the marriage between earth and sky. That's exactly what they're talking about, the father and the mother. But it was not in terms so much as of male and female as it was father and mother, which is a very different concept. Male and female then become included within father and mother. And that is a very different meaning than saying the male sky and the female earth, which brings in explicit kind of sexuality, which the Pueblo people weren't so much interested in as in the parental nature of mother and father within which creation happens, because it's only when the male and female come together as father and mother and children are produced that creation really happens. This is the creation right now, because those two have come around us. In that sense, then, Pueblo people talk about as community as having mothers and fathers and children. And, you know, the oldest people are always talked about as father. And then their mothers in those communities also. Many, whether they're your mothers or not, whether they're your fathers, they're known as. But then everybody else is children. But those people are also children. But the flexibility of roles in that way. But the notion of having people who are responsible and nurturing and caring about the entire context that one lives in. It's that kind of model that was taken from the way they saw the cosmos as being structured, the way the cosmos is ordered. It is within that context that we live, yeah.
Lillian Hill is a young Hopi woman who attended Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff and who retains her Hopi identity.
Within the songs that we learn when we're really young or that we're exposed to, a lot of these songs talk about the relationship that the earth has to the clouds, or that the clouds have with different animals and things like that. And one of the ways that we describe the earth is the earth as a woman or as our mother, and that's how we treat her and that's how we believe in her. And so the word that we use is, even in our songs, it's duwakatsi. And what that means is that the life of the soil, the life of the land, and it's not something that is without recognition that it's alive, that it's a living being. In these words that we have for referring to the land or to different animals, there's always that word duwa, how you describe the sky, omva. When you're talking about these things, about yoyoki, about these ways that we describe nature, it has a really deep meaning, because the way that we learn these things is in the context of songs and honoring the earth and the clouds.
We're emotionally connected to our landscape in its entirety. We can articulate that connection to hundreds, if not thousands, of points on the landscape. So it's like a spider web that's connected to all of these things. And then all Hopis are connected to the spider web. So we're all interconnected, and we cover this ground up here in our conscious, in our subconscious, in our culture, in our language. And this is all personifies itself in our day-to-day thoughts when we think about that landscape.
Ancestral people moved through this region for thousands of years. And the intimacy that they developed with the land, I think, is what has kept them going for so long in such a place. And even today, I think we've forgotten that that has helped our people survive for so long, is that intimacy that we had with the land, with the place, with the rocks, the mountains. Part of that intimacy, of course, was, especially in this region, is to know where the water areas are. The water is seen as being absolutely important for life. Without it, creation doesn't happen. You know, it's the semen of the Father that keeps creation going. The snaking water through this region, the Rio Grande, the lakes, and of course throughout all of Pueblo mythology, the lakes are very important. All water places are extremely important, because without water we don't survive here. And it's so sparse that they do have to become very special places. There are also those places at which energy, the energy of the world, is very strong, because there are also openings to go to the underworlds, where to other levels of existence. There are openings also into the other world. The Rio Grande is a place that is also frightening to the Pueblo. It's frightening because it comes with incredible power. It's the power. And that's why I think that we talk about the water, wind, breath, because the power of all of creation is there. And it can be in the wind, and it is and certainly in the water, especially in that strong flowing water that we know it. You know, and the word in Tewa for Rio Grande is Osonge, the large water place.
Hopis would see, besides the major sites, ones that are in many people's vocabulary, there's many lesser sites. But if you look at important sites such as Wapaki, Homolovi, Chaco, Canyon de Chelly, Mesa Verde, Aztec, each of these sites have a Hopi name, and it has meaning to Hopi, because these are places where Hopis stopped and occupied these places during the migrations. These stories are contained in the clan histories, and each clan has their own history about all of the places that they stopped from the time of emergence until they came to the center place here at the core of Hopi land, which would be First, Second, and Third Mesa. These stories are not only contained within the clan histories, they are also contained within songs that retrace the migrations that are significant in Hopi history, so that these names are evoked frequently at Hopi, even though we no longer physically occupy some of these places. Also, at most of these places, we still have active shrines where Hopis go back for various reasons to leave offerings at these places.
In the Hopi way I was taught, Ma Sao had only three things he told us. He had a gourd of water, an ear of corn, and a planting stick. He said, this is all I have. And my life revolves around these three things. And that if we want to stay here with him, we have to do the same. That's what we were taught. The corn represents us people, our soul. The gourd of water is our connection to the Creator. It is given when we do the right thing. It's a blessing. And the planting stick is a tool. It's technology. So the basic idea is that we have to use technology to keep our environment healthy. If it's sick, to cure it. You know, we have to use technology to keep ourselves healthy and keep our connections to the Creator strong, not to sever it. If we don't do this, the technology will go on its own and it'll replace God. And that means we're getting ready for the next world. It means that there is going to have to be a cleansing.
I think tradition and community go hand in hand. You really, in a way, can't have one without the other, because tradition, it is really about rootedness. It is about a group of people having been alive within a place for a long period of time and having set up certain ways of behaving, certain ways of doing things. All of that is tradition. And that takes time. It takes a long time for people to feel comfortable with being in a certain place. I have to wake up every single morning, be aware of where the sun comes up over those mountains, and be careful about watching. Oh, now it's this time. Now it should be coming up right over that peak right there. And what does that mean? It means a whole lot for me, because every morning then I am in connection with that sun out there, in the sense that, no, here's my world right here. And depending on where that sun comes up this morning, I know whether I'm going to have to build a fire or not. If you see a direct connection to you in that way, you know, it's not about much more than just really seeing those different elements that come to create a place for you within which you feel comfortable and safe. What if that sun didn't come out where it was supposed to come out? I mean, the place would fall apart. Literally, I mean, there'd be no more place. But we lose that sense that if those rhythms that we just take for granted, traditional rhythms or whatever they are, if they don't continue, if I don't know that my grandmother is not going to be there and have a pot of beans going as a child, then it does start falling apart. Then there aren't rhythms. Having a grandmother is a natural rhythm as having the sun come up every day.
A lot of the ways that we refer to the earth and to those animals and plants and to the clouds and rains that come is through a lot of the ceremonies and songs that we're exposed to when we're really young. And so within these songs, the songs are about a lot of things. They're about pollination, about different types of rains that come. So we learn to recognize and also to know different types of weather patterns. There's all types of rain that come, and there's a lot of different words for them. Like Sububuta is the rain that comes like kind of gently down, and Yoyoki is rain that just, you know, continually comes. And the ways that you describe those things, it comes with a way of experiencing it also. It's just like, well, yesterday it rained like this, and so in your mind, you can recognize the experience of seeing rain falling that way and actually smelling how it smells when it rains like that. All of those things, those recognitions come with how we recognize different types of rains and also with the land, the different seasons. Every moon that comes has its own name and has its own activities. We do these different things during these different moons. there's a name for a moon that's called Hakitanmuya, and that means the waiting moon. After the men have planted the seeds and we're waiting for those things, and there's different activities that we have, but we know by these different names of the moons what needs to be done. We learn those at a very young age, and so we learn how to associate those types of ways of describing things in our language. Those are the things that we use to kind of help to guide our activities, what we're going to do during those times.
Trees are living beings. Rocks are living beings. The spirit moves through the water. An incredible word that we have for the source of life is something we talk about as the Bo-wa-ha, the water, wind, breath. It is there in the water and in the wind that we can see the spirit, that we can see life moving. It's there where the life force is visible, as well as in the clouds, of course. We don't take the life force and put it in a superhuman being as Christians do with God. That already begins to show us the focus on human beings when you put the life force in a superhuman creature. We keep it within the trees, within the water, within the wind, within the clouds. And we are to move through that context of the water, the wind, and breathe the same breath that we are breathing, the same breath that the rocks do, that the wind does. That gives you a totally different feeling. This is it. There's no other reality. We don't go to heaven. We don't leave this dirty world to go to a golden, clean heaven. We are here. This is it. This is the world. It doesn't get any better than this. And if we don't honor it in the sense that this is the best, as beautiful as it's ever going to be, then we can't take care of it if we think that it's a place to be shunned and that we have better things to look forward to. Then we can't walk respectfully where we are at this moment and take care of things and touch things with honor and breathe each breath. That's what that water, wind, breath is about. It's, my goodness, here it is. And every second I can breathe it in and I become a part of this world. In no uncertain terms, I am a part of this world that I live in every second because I breathe it every second.
Within every aspect of life, daily activities, the language is always there. That's what we use to communicate with one another and also to communicate with the different spirits or the different beings that are there also in the world. And so within everything from preparing food to planting to harvesting to gathering plants for food, all of those different activities that we do, there's a lot of different types of language that we use when we do those things. And even for babies, when babies are born, there's a language that you use to talk with them, and that's called Tsatsak Lavai. And what Tsatsak Lavai is it's a language that's only used to teach little kids, babies, to little ones. So they learn, that's their first language that they learn, is Tsatsak Lavai. And so throughout their lives and throughout the lives of the children when they grow, they learn how to use different ways of speaking Hopi. They learn those ways. More formal language is when you're in the kiva and when you're addressing a lot of the older people. You learn those languages too, songs, those things. But when a lot of changes occurred is when the people went to the boarding schools and when the government started forcing those things on the people. And so during that time, when people would speak their language, they would be punished. And that's when a lot of things changed with the use of the native language. When language is not utilized anymore, there's a whole knowledge that comes with the use of language. Even for hunting, there's all of those words that are used to describe the animals and the parts of the bodies of the animals and the knowledge that exists there. And with cooking also, there's all the words and the terminology for different things. And when we're not using that language anymore to describe those things that we're doing, a lot of the knowledge that we have too is not being utilized or it's not being taught. One thing that I see is that we learned how to speak and how to utilize language by doing things, by doing different activities, by participating in things. And that's where we learned how to speak Hopi, or that's where we learned the language. And right now, a lot of young people in the schools are learning how to speak it by writing it. And they're not necessarily involved in doing things like grinding corn or cooking, preparing meals or hunting or any of those types of things. They're learning kind of in a different setting or a different context. But I think it's really important that we continue those ways of communicating in our language through actually participating in those activities that we've done for a long time now, and talking to the young people in that way. I think with the knowledge that Indigenous peoples have, and with Hopi, the knowledge that we have, a lot of it cannot easily be communicated or translated into English. And so it's a way of understanding how you are related to everything, how you're related to the land.
You know, the amazing thing is that the basic Pueblo beliefs aren't language specific. The Hopis, for instance, speak a totally different language, Zunis, Karas, from us. And yet the major ideas of what we call the Pueblo world are the same in spite of very different languages. So it really makes me feel that that relationship to land, relationship to place, which all of us experience together, we all have that basic relationship, and we talk about it in essentially the same way. Father sky, mother earth, children, this, that, the need for connection, relationship. But yet the languages are very, very different languages. They're not even related languages like with the Hopi. And yet the ideas that grew out of the land are very much the same. It was the land that dictated what we were to believe and how we were to behave. And, you know, language now is being made a big thing of, because it's the one thing that people can hold on to say that'll take us back into our traditions. Yes, it's an avenue, it's a way to do it. But the more basic thing is stop, what is our relationship to place? That's what brought up the traditions in the first place. And that's what brought up the language anyway. And the language expresses it. But it's not a dependency on language. It's something more basic.
It is vitally important that we listen carefully to these highly intelligent Native Americans, whose traditional perspectives addressing the relationship of our species to habitat are founded in wisdom and sanity. The lens of mythic perspective provides a broad and penetrating intuitive view into the many-faceted crystal of reality. Science also provides yet another powerful glimpse at reality. Ideally, we must meld our intuitions with our intellect as we attempt to perceive where we stand on this tiny planet. The Lore of the Land is made possible through the sponsorship of the Museum of New Mexico Foundation and the New Mexico Humanities Council, with funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the continuing support from the Ford Foundation. For the Lore of the Land, this is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.